I reserve 3 minutes.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Cody Siegfried on behalf of appellants. This case involves the interpretation of a will and where intent is to be found. In this case, it involves primarily three assignments of error. The primary assignment of error is how the court interpreted the will and where they found intent. The county court found that Article 4 of the will, which is the exercise of power of the power of appointment, showed Jones' intent to leave the real estate and property as set forth in Article 4, regardless of whether or not it was held in a trust or individually. So the court placed no significance on whether or not the property owned by Jones was held in a trust or not. Also, the court, I believe, ignored the rules of this court, the rules set out in In Re Estate of Mosel when it interpreted the will. It did not examine the will in its entirety. It did not consider and liberally interpret every provision of the will. It did not employ the generally accepted literal and grammatical meanings of the words used in the will. And it did not assume that the maker of the will understood the words that were used in the will. And I also believe the county court, the appellants contend, disregarded this court's rule as set forth in Anarjasky versus Anarjasky. In that case, it says when there are definite and unambiguous provisions in a will, that other expressions in a will that are capable of more than one construction must be so construed, if reasonably practicable, as to harmonize with the plain provisions of the will. So essentially what the court did here was look at Article 4 in isolation. The county court totally ignored Article 3.04. Article 3.04 of the will is essentially a residuary clause.
Let's start with the power of appointment of the trust. Is the trust terminated? Is it not terminated? Do we know? Does
yes.
the record show that?
The court found that the trust was terminated in its order on page 5, I believe. It said it was effectively terminated.
Were any assets of the trust removed from the trust and placed in someone else's name?
That is the issue. There was an inventory filed by one of the appellees, Steve Barger, when he was serving as a personal representative. On that inventory, that does list the property under Schedule B, stocks and bonds, and rather than Schedule G, which is where revocable trust assets would go. But the court did find the trust was terminated.
So at the time the will was drafted and executed, the trust had not yet been terminated.
That is correct. The will was from March of 2006. Then there was a resolution of trustees to terminate the trust signed in July of 2006.
The court acknowledges that in August of 2006.
That's correct. Yeah, there was a county court case in Red Willow County involving that trust. There was a motion to dismiss filed by Joan Barger, and that Exhibit A to that motion to dismiss was the resolution of the trustees to terminate the trust. That was all accepted.
So is the power of appointment ineffective as a result of the termination of the trust?
That is our contention.
Have we ever said that?
Excuse me?
Have we ever said that?
I don't believe there's any case law on that. I'm going off the restatement third by way of analogy. In the restatement, it talks about in comments B, section 18.2, in reference to an inter vivos trust, that the power to revoke that trust carries with it the power to revoke power of appointment in that trust. This was an irrevocable trust, however, essentially was revoked. So we're asking the court to determine that, yes, when the trust was terminated, the power was also terminated with it. And to the extent Article 4 of the will, which is entitled Exercise of Power of Appointment, to the extent the will tries to exercise the power of appointment, all of Article 4 fails.
Does that create any ambiguity?
No. I don't believe it does, because Article 3 of the will is all about disposition of property. And Article 3.04 of the will said it's the general residuary clause. That's where the destinant leaves all of her property, which is not property of the trust, to four of her five children. So the will is also, if you look at the will, it recognizes its ambulatory nature. It's contingent upon status quo existing on the decedent's date of death.
So is Article 3
limited to property? The powers that are in Article 3, property?
Maybe, I don't have a good answer for that.
Well, there exist powers of appointment that can cover both appointing people to do stuff and appointing assets to be designated to certain beneficiaries. So I'm trying to hone in on power of appointment. Is power of appointment in 4 to appoint people and power of appointment in 3 to deal with the property? Or is there an ambiguity of the scope of power of appointment in this case?
I don't believe there is an ambiguity of the scope. I think the bill references, she's using the power of appointment granted her in the Barker Family Irrevocable Trust. In Article 4, she references that and disposes of property, Article 4. I believe in Article 3, there's a passing reference in some point. This is also my exercise of power of appointment in the trust. I believe it's referencing all property, it's not referencing persons to, naming persons, exercise.
Thank you.
There's no more questions, I guess I'll reserve the remainder of my time for.
What about probable cause? And the will contest language?
The probable cause, Article 5 of the will is the no contest clause. We believe, I don't think the court's ever held this, but a no contest clause should be strictly construed. And we believe a strict construction of that clause requires someone to file a proceeding to fall within the meaning of that clause. Here, the court found that merely supporting a will contest makes those persons fall within the provision. So the court took a broad interpretation of file, but we believe other states, such as neighboring state of Colorado and New York, they all recognize in their cases that no contest clauses are disfavored and they must be strictly construed. And I think that serves a good purpose because a person who procures a will through undue influence, through fraud, through artifice, they should not be rewarded. And the jurisdiction of the court should not be defeated. Persons who have probable cause to bring a will contest proceeding should have their day in court. And I think that serves a good public policy.
So if we get past the issue of direct or indirect will contest, was there sufficient probable cause to test this will?
There was ample probable cause. The record is full of it. You look at the testimony of one of appellants, Elizabeth Siegfried, as well as the other children. They firsthand observed their mother. They observed her throughout all of the relevant time. And they observed the dominating influence of Steve Barker and her son. He's out at the farm every day. They observed Steve used demeaning language, calling their mother Joni. They observed documents showing that the attorney that drafted the will was also serving as the attorney for Steve Barker at the time. They also had knowledge that the decedent here did not have advice from an independent attorney dedicated solely to her interest. The will contestants knew that. They knew that the main beneficiary under the will and the decedent were sharing the same attorney. They knew that the main beneficiary of the will was present at the will's making, present at the will's signing. So I think the record is full of ample instances of probable cause. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal if I may.
Thank you very much.
This is Mr. Fugate.
My name is Al Fugate. I represent the appellee Shane Barker. Mr. Nelson represents the appellee Stephen Barker. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of our time. Mr. Nelson, I will address the issue of decedent's intent, termination of the trust, and exercise of the power of appointment. Mr. Nelson will address the issue of probable cause. The North Star of this case is the freedom of disposition of property. There's no right of a citizen more valued than the right to dispose of property as that person determines. The cardinal rule concerning a decedent's will is to give effect to that decedent's intention unless it is contrary to law or contrary to public policy. The argument of the appellant is fatally flawed in at least 3 ways, and the first way is it's contrary to what the decedent's intent was. We're asking the court to affirm the trial court's ruling that the decedent's intent was that her property, stock, and her farm corporations passed according to Article 4, which contained a power of appointment, and that was her intent. She made her intent clear in this case, and one of the ways she did that was on July 26, 2006, after she'd already exercised her will, she signed a release of the trustees of that trust and stated in that, "I hereby affirm I have already exercised my power of appointment in my will."
So are we reviewing extrinsic evidence at that point, and do we have to determine there's ambiguity in the will before we do that?
That is extrinsic evidence, but that extrinsic evidence was offered and introduced by the appellant in this case. And the trial court found that there was a latent ambiguity.
So we had to find an ambiguity?
We had to find that, looking at the words of the wills themselves and applying that to the circumstances concerning the termination of the trust, that there's a latent ambiguity.
So the latent ambiguity is a termination of the trust?
Latent ambiguity is applying the words of the will in that context, I believe, yes.
Well, the will itself, the language of the will is not ambiguous, is it? If we just read the will...
The language of the will is fairly clear, Your Honor, that Article 1 tells you why she did this and why she favored certain heirs. Article 3 says, "I exclude stuff that's in the trust." And Article 4 says, "Here's what I want to do with the stuff that was in the trust." And by executing that release and affirming that she'd already exercised her power of appointment when she executed her will, she made it clear that whether or not the stock was in trust or out of trust, here's how I want it to go, and that's what the trial court found, and that's the ruling that we're asking you to affirm.
Trial court also relied on the testimony of Arlen Wine, is that correct?
I believe so, and that witness was called by the appellant, Your Honor, so if there's error, they invited it. The trust, in my opinion, is still in existence. The trustees passed a resolution of the trust that said, "Trust is hereby terminated on the date set forth below, subject to the conveyance of the trust estate to Joan Barger." That subject to makes that termination conditional, and that condition has never occurred. Stock certificates are still sitting in the name of the trustees in the trust, waiting for the trust to be terminated and wound up.
Do we know that?
Yes, we know that. That's in the
record. That's in the record?
Yeah. The stock certificates are in the record. Mr. Wine testified he didn't transfer them out of trust. Both trustees, Mr. Barger.
Some of the stock certificates lost?
Pardon me?
Were some of the stock certificates lost?
No, Your Honor. Corporate records couldn't be found, although when you look back in the record, there's a reference in the brief to Mr. Barger, William Barger, saying that his attorney had all the corporate records, which is Mr. Bowman. The key to this, though, on the termination of trust, I believe, is the power of appointment was exercised at the time the will was executed, because there's no evidence in this record of any restriction, prohibition, or limitation on the exercise of that power of appointment. And without that, that power of appointment is presently exercisable in any time, at any time, in any mode, by any manner. And she did that when she executed her will and said, "I hereby exercise my power of appointment. I point this property and give it here to Stephen Barger in trust. Here's what you're supposed to do with it."
Joan had multiple wills before this one, is that correct?
She did.
She ever exercised power of appointments in those wills?
Not to my knowledge.
If she had, would that have any impact on your argument today?
I don't believe so, because the only will at issue is the one that's been admitted to probate and has been appealed, and that's been affirmed. So we're dealing with that will. Although all the prior wills disinherited Mr. William Barger, who was the named petitioner in the will contest. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to try and answer those. Otherwise, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Nelson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nelson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Patrick Nelson. I'm here speaking on behalf of Appellee Stephen Barger, one of the five siblings of the will contestants and son of Joanne Barger. The validity of and enforceability of the no contest provision contained in Joanne Barger's will is what's at issue in this part of the appeal. The trial court found and determined that the will contest provision was valid and but for the probable cause issue enforceable against all will contestants, William Barger, Joseph Barger, Brendan Barger, and Elizabeth Siegfried. Nebraska Probate Code Section 30-24103 is the will contest provision contained in the Nebraska statutes. This is the first case that addresses that. It has never been addressed by this court or the Court of Appeals. It's a fairly short statute. I don't normally like to read things to the court, but It says, quote, "A provision in a will purporting to penalize any interested person for contesting the will or instituting other proceedings relating to the estate is unenforceable if probable cause exists for instituting proceedings." That's short and sweet. That's what the statute says. The restatement third, following up the restatement second, fleshes that out and was relied upon substantially by both sides at trial and on appeal here in our briefs. The restatement provision itself talks about probable cause existed in the past tense, whereas the statute says exists in the present tense. But it really is an issue of what was known, what facts were known by the will contestants at the time the will contest petition was filed, that when it was commenced, that would support contesting the will. And it's a fairly simple and straightforward concept. What did they know? Who, what, where, when, and why? Not what they believed and what they felt and what they thought was fair or not fair, but what were the facts then known by the contestants? And that's it. And in analyzing what was then known by these contestants, the answer is not very much at all. The will was signed on March 13 of 2006. The will contest petition was filed after Joanne Barger died in 2012. So we have a 6-year time frame. And there's very little evidence at all about what was going on in Joanne Barger's life on March 13, 2006, when she signed the will. There is evidence, especially from the will contest trial itself, which was conducted after full discovery. Mr. Wine was deposed, the parties were deposed, everything was fleshed out. But what was known, and the key to this case, is what was known by the will contestants when they filed the will contest petition, the complaint. The issues that the trial court relied upon, what were, what did Arlen Wine have to do and what did he testify about at the time when Joanne Barger signed the will? That was all after the fact. That was not disclosed to the appellants, the will contestants, prior to the commencement of the case.
I beg your pardon, at any time prior to the filing of the contest?
Yes. Now, Mr. Wine met with some of the contestants prior to the will contest petition, the complaint being filed, but he didn't disclose anything of that nature. What he disclosed was there were 5 total wills, and that's it. That's it.
Did he also advise that he suggested that Joan have a new attorney draft the will because of his relationship with Joan and Steve?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of that. Did he discuss that?
Didn't he discuss with the other siblings that he had advised Joan to maybe seek a different attorney to represent her?
Yes, he did. And
does that cause any concern?
No, it does not. Well, I guess to answer it, under all circumstances, yes, it does, because he represented Steve, he represented other Barger family members too, Brandon and William, in addition to Joanne and the two corporations involved. So we had quite a bit of contact with the family, and it was the family connection that caused him to be a little bit concerned about whether he should do this or not. Not because he had any sort of a conflict of interest, although the contestants assert that he was at that time representing Steve Barger. All that was going on in Steve Barger's legal life at that time was a bankruptcy case that there was no active matters pending at all. So there was a Chapter 12 case that was continuing, but it wasn't anything that it involved any legal work on the part of Mr. Wine.
How should we define probable cause? How should we define it?
Just exactly, Your Honor, as it is defined in the restatement I submit. And what it says, and again, I'm quoting here, I'm sorry, probable cause exists when, at the time of instituting the proceeding, there was evidence that would lead a reasonable person, properly informed and advised, to conclude that there was a substantial likelihood that the challenge would be successful. Substantial likelihood. That's not just an iffy, perhaps a maybe. That's a substantial likelihood. In other evidentiary matters, it's almost like a presumption, a presumptive evidence versus a 50% plus one. It's a high standard that you have to come to meet. And if you don't meet it, you haven't satisfied your burden, and it is the contestant's burden, not the will proponent's burden, to establish this probable cause. And unless they meet that standard, they lose. I say I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes,
1 minute and 23 seconds, Mr. Siegfried.
Thank you. All right, to speak to, as Mr. Nelson said, what was known and when, I think the evidence shows that, look at the brief, the three alleged contestants, we don't concede that they fall within the bill, they all had the knowledge prior to March 31, 2012. March 31, 2012, that's the date that the will contest proceeding was filed. All three of them met with attorney Arlen Wine. He testified as to how he met with Beth, Joe, Brendan, and Bill after Joan's death and told them about the series of wills, gave them copies of the wills, and told them that he was uncomfortable writing the wills. That's all in the supplemental transcript, page 635, page 636, page 638. And also, as far as Joan's health issues, their children would have observed all of those health issues, all of these behaviors around the time of the making of the will. The time after the will is made is also relevant, given the will's ambulatory nature. A person can obviously change their will at any time. Joan Barger was actually very good at making wills. You would think she would know that. And so any conduct after the will was made, once the undue influencer, you know, gets his purpose in place in the will, now he prevents her from changing the will. All of this is relevant time, and all of the contestants had this knowledge prior to the filing of the will contest. And also as to intent should be found by looking at the will itself. And the will itself is pretty clear and unambiguous, that it operates at the time of her death, and that Article 4 is the exercise of power of appointment as found in the will. And appellants would just respectfully request that this court reverse the portion of the lower court's order finding that Joan did make proper disposition of her property through Article 4. We ask that this court order that actually all of her property is distributable to four of her five children pursuant to Article 3.04. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Blaha.